Okay, last week we discussed elephants. This week I want to move into birds. I want to discuss a few different birds. Now, if you could get a hold of a chumash, I don't want to use a chumash for this session. Sefer Bamidbar. You might want to have one in English too. Okay, who has a chumash handy? Can you let me know if you have a chumash, or if you can get one easily, or if you can't? Hi, Bob. Can you get a chumash? Okay. Sefer Bamidbar 11. Okay. Sefer Bamidbar chapter 11, verse 4. Okay. Okay. This is talking about the Jewish people in the wilderness. And they're going to start complaining. It was among them. They had a craving. Oh, somebody's joining. Okay, somebody else is just joining us. Stephanie. Hi, Stephanie. If you have a chumash, we want meat. Who will feed us meat? Says we remember the fish that we had in Egypt, and the cucumbers, and the melons, and the leeks, and so on and so forth. They wanted meat. They weren't happy with the man. So Moshe turned to Hashem. Moshe says to Hashem, you know, the people are complaining, they want meat. Now if you look in verse 13, Moshe says, where shall I get meat to give to people when they come to me saying, give us meat so we can eat? Right, Moshe is saying, there's a lot of people here, how am I going to get meat for? Okay, somebody else has joined us. As follows, look in verse 18, okay? To the people you shall say, prepare yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. You have cried in the ears of God, saying, who will feed us meat? And so on. So God will give you meat, and you will eat. And here in verse 19, not for one day shall you eat, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days. An entire month of days, until it comes out of your nose, and becomes nauseating to you, until you're sick of it, because you have rejected God in your midst. Okay, so Hashem says that he's going to give meat to the Jewish people until it... So then, in verse 10, 600,000 soldiers are in this people, and you say give them meat and they're going to eat for a whole month? Can sheep and cattle be slaughtered for them and suffice? Right? Moses saying, how are you possibly going to supply meat to so many people? So God says to Moses, is the hand of God limited? Now you'll see whether my word comes to pass or not. Now what's going on here? How on earth could Moshe be expressing doubt as to whether God could provide meat for all the people? He's God. He can do anything. So the answer is as follows. Of course, Moshe knows that God can do anything. However, Moshe understood that God was saying that he was going to provide meat via natural means. You see, miracles, we're not so big into miracles. Miracles are few and far between in the Torah, and when they do happen, it's because of exceptional circumstances. And either it happens at a time of great salvation for the Jewish people, or it happens at a time of great punishment for the very wicked. Right, so you have like the splitting of the Red Sea, a time of great salvation, or you have the earth swallowing up Korah, a time of great evil. Right, so miracles are very black and white events. They only happen for great salvation or great punishment. But these circumstances didn't fall into any of those categories. Right, here we're talking about, on the one hand it was good, it was giving food, sustaining them. But on the other hand, they were complaining about it. They were complaining about this food. So these weren't circumstances that warranted a supernatural miracle. And really we should add that even when there are miracles, they tend to happen within a naturalistic framework. Even the splitting of the Red Sea. It says that the wind blew all night. And the classical Jewish commentators say that it happened within a semi-naturalistic. So, and that was in the case of, you know, where it was a case of extreme salvation. So certainly here, when it wasn't one of those circumstances, what Moshe understood was that it wouldn't be via, you know, a supernatural, spectacular miracle that God would be providing meat to the entire Jewish people. So Moshe was asking, you know, how on earth are you going to provide meat for them within natural means? So Hashem said, you know, don't worry, I'm God. So what did he do? What says in verse 31, right, a wind went forth from Hashem, quails from the sea, and spread them over the camp, a day's journey this way and a day's journey that way, all around the camp, and 2 cubits above the face of the earth. Now, we can't do PowerPoint presentations because we have some issues with that this week, but I have something else to show you. Hold on a second. Go. You all see that? Wow. Calm down. Calm down. Okay. Can you see that? There we have a quail. A real live quail that I just took from my aviary in my garden. This is the... Ow. Okay. This is the same type of quail that they had in the wilderness. Right, can you all see it? Can you just drop me an instant message or tell me if you can see it? See how close this camera can focus. Alright, Fanny, sorry you can't see it. Oh, one second, my screensaver just kicked in. Okay, so this is the same type of quail that they have in the wilderness. It's called Excatronix. Whoa, I'm sorry. Don't want it to fly around my room. Okay, I'll put him back in the box. Alright, quail. Okay, there you have it, the real thing. Coturnix, known variously as the European quail or the Japanese quail. I'm not an ornithologist. I'm an amateur ornithologist. Okay, so this is, there was an interesting thing about quails. Quails, they spend summers. Okay, Rick wants to know, why would God consider the loss of meat so negatively? Well, essentially, it was ingratitude. It's perhaps, you know, the way they expressed it. They were complaining, even though God had saved them from Egypt, and it should have this eternal gratitude, and instead they start complaining. So okay, so here's how quails were the means of supplying a very large number of people with meat by naturalistic means. See, quails, they spend their summers in Europe, and they spend their winters in Africa. And when they migrate, they all migrate together in vast, vast groups. And the passage says that they were 2 cubits above the face of the earth. Right? That's about 3 or 4 feet high. And the quails, as you saw with my little quail here, they're kind of fat. They're not the greatest flyers, so they're not flying very high above the ground. And what happens is they all fly in together at the same time at that height. Now, in the early part of the 20th century, what they used to do in Egypt was just string nets along the coastline, and they'd capture millions of quails that were flying in across the sea. They'd capture several million quails each season, just by holding the nets out there. And the quails migrate in such vast numbers that Pliny the Elder, the Roman naturalist, he claimed that they would sometimes land on sink the ships. The weight of the quails was so much that the ships would sink. So they come over in these vast numbers, and because it's so easy to catch them, they were hunted to close to extinction. So luckily it was that form of catching them was outlawed, and now they're gradually making a recovery. But they come in vast numbers, and that's how it was possible to provide food to the entire Jewish people by naturalistic means. You'll see that it says that the wind swept the quails from the sea, which is that's how they fly over the sea. And it sent them down exhausted. It says the Yitosh Alamachne, it sent them down over the camp, because once they come over the sea, they're exhausted and they can barely fly. And okay, then it says that the people gathered them up, verse 32. Right. So the people rose up all that day and all the night and all the next day, and they gathered up the quail. The one who gathered the leaves gathered in 10 bushels worth, and they spread them out around the camp. What's the idea of spreading them out? So there were people who didn't understand what this means, that you spread them out. How are you going to, what good are they going to do to spread them out once you've caught them and shattered them? The answer is that, you know, it's true that where we live, if you put a quail outside after it's dead, it's just going to rot. But they were in the desert. In the desert, the way you preserve things is leaving it out in the hot sun to dry out, you know, like dotong. And that's how the Bedouins, that's what they still do. They when they kill villages then. Okay? So this is how the miracle occurred, which wasn't a supernatural miracle. This is how, within a naturalistic framework, meat for everyone. Jerky. Beef jerky. Yeah. Thanks, Rick. That's how it was. Okay, now, watch how that the verses continue. Verse 33. The meat was still between their teeth, not yet chewed, when the anger of God flared against the people, a mighty blow against the people. He named that place Kibros Hataiva, which is the graves of lust, because they buried the people who had been lusting for the meat. Okay, so here, the people who had been complaining the most got punished for their complaining, and God struck them and killed them. Now, it doesn't elaborate here what it means that he struck them. You know, doesn't mean that a bolt of lightning came down from the heavens? So presumably not, because again, we're just saying that supernatural miracles only happen in extreme circumstances. If the bringing of the quail was not done in a supernatural way, then the punishment too should have been not in a supernatural way. So what some of the commentators explain is that the people died as a result of poisoning from the quails. And this is very interesting, because there is a mysterious disease known as Coturnism. C-O-T-U-R-N-I-S-M. Coturnism. It is named after the quail. The quail's Latin name, as we said earlier, is Coturnix Coturnix. And this is a disease that you only get from eating quails. You don't get it from any other thing. The only cause of it is eating quails. It's a severe form of rhabdomyolysis. It involves violent muscle pain, paralysis, renal failure, and sometimes resulting in death. Now, it's a bit of a mysterious disease. You don't always get it from eating quail. You know, I've eaten quail many times, and I'm still here. What happens is it comes from quails at certain stages during their migration. Quails eat different types of food while they're migrating along the countries, and it seems that at certain times during the migration they eat certain seeds that that makes them poisonous. So that's why it's perfectly safe to eat quails in a restaurant, because they're from quails that are being raised in captivity and aren't going to be eating these seeds. So let's have a look back in the Pesukim, and we'll see if this works, to see that the Pesukim are talking about the people dying from being from paternalism. Okay, I'm going to turn my sound down a little bit. Let's see if that improves the sound quality. Okay. So it says that the meat was still between their teeth when they were struck with this plague. Now that seems to raise a problem, because paternalism begins to take effect 1 to 10 hours after eating the meat. People were struck down while the meat was still between their teeth. But this isn't necessarily a problem, because one of the commentators, Stefano, says that the Torah here is using a metaphor, saying that the meat, you know, it's like before when God said he's going to give them meat until it's coming out of their nose, literally mean coming out of their nose, it's a figure of speech. So to hear saying that they were struck down while the meat was still between their teeth doesn't mean that literally as they put their bag in they dropped dead. It means that while they were in, you know, while they were still sitting at the meal, or while they were still feeling satiated from the food, that's when the plague took effect, which would fit in with this disease known as paternalism. Now, the difficulty... of here, and yet here we see that the plague, in Tehillim, it says that the plague killed the young men of Israel. You know, the paternalism generally only affects weak people, and here it didn't only affect weak people. However, one answer I saw is that paternalism is thought to be more severe if people exert themselves before eating quails. It's the exertion, when you feel worn out after exertion, makes you more susceptible to the disease. In which case here, it's the people who would have been running around the most to capture the most quails who would have been affected the most by paternalism. So therefore it would have been a very appropriate form of divine justice. That the people who are the most overwhelmed by lust and by desire, they're the ones who would be exerting themselves the most to catch the quails. And they're the ones who would be the most badly affected by eating quails. Okay, so that's an interesting insight into how our contemporary knowledge of ornithology sheds light on this chapter in the Torah. Now, since we're discussing birds tonight, let's move on to a different topic. Okay, I've got a little view. You know, when you go into a store to buy food, say you look for a hechsher, right? You look for kosher certification. However, there are certain foods that you can buy without any form of kosher certification, and that even the most Orthodox Jews will buy without any kosher certification at all. Any ideas? You can speak up. Or you can instant message everyone. Olive oil. Olive oil. Olive oil, olives grown in Israel would have to have Truma and Maaser, like various tax taken from them, so you'd need to have some certification that was done. Any other guesses? Fruits and vegetables, again, that's true in the United States, but if it comes from Israel, you again have to make sure that the Truma and Maaser, the tithes, were taken from them. Fish is a good one. Yep, you can buy fish without kosher certification. We'll find it later, we'll discuss the reasons for that. What else? Actually, water. Okay. Water, yes. Yes. What else? You know, might expect. Occasion. Beer? Could be, I don't know. Honey, yep, that is true. You can buy honey without kosher certification. Yeah, honey. Even though, in theory, honey, not as it's prepared, as it used to be prepared, could contain little pieces of bee, but they're considered to be irrelevant. Yeah, considered to be a negligible amount. So another thing that you can buy without kosher certification is eggs. Right? You can buy eggs without kosher certification. Now, how do you know that these are kosher eggs from a kosher bird? So before we address that question, I want to ask a more basic question. How do you know that even the eggs of a kosher bird are kosher? How do you know that you can eat eggs of a kosher bird? Now you might think, well, you know, obviously you can, why not? But it's not so obvious. Let's say, for argument's sake, let's say geckos were kosher. Right, they're not. You know what a gecko is, right? Those little cute lizards? They advertise. So, geckos, you know, when they're panicking, and they have an enemy chasing them, so they'll make their tail drop off, and they run away, leaving the tail as a payoff for the predator. So if the gecko was kosher, could you eat its tail? Open question to the audience. Alright, nobody's answering. I'll tell you the answer. The answer is no. You could not. Because it would be Eva Minachai, right? A part of a living creature. You're not allowed to eat part of a living creature, right? You're not allowed to eat part of an animal if that animal is still alive. So how do you know that doesn't apply to eggs? No. That you're allowed to eat an egg, right? The bird, the chicken lays an egg. The chicken's still alive. How do you know that the egg is a problem of Eva Minachai? So there are a couple of answers. Anyone want to guess? Anyone want to come up with a reason? Some of them you might be able to guess. How do you know that you're allowed to eat eggs? Nobody got any ideas? It's just not a part of it. It's a product. That's a good argument, but how do you know that that's the case? Right? In other words, what proof do we have from the Torah that that's the case? What proof do we have from the Torah that it's not considered to be a part of the animal, that it's considered to be a product, that it's something that you can eat? So, here's one answer. Shiloh HaKein. Right, there's a commandment in the Torah of sending away the mother bird before you take her eggs. So, the implication there is that you can eat a bird's eggs. Now, that is one of the, you know, because this is a question that's discussed in halachic sources. How do you know you're allowed to eat eggs? So, one of the reasons given is that the Torah says that it gives this whole mitzvah of sending away the mother bird before you take the eggs. So, that indicates that the eggs are, as you say, a product of the animal. They're not considered to be able to a high. Another answer, another way in which you know that you can eat eggs is that there's a principle in halacha that anything that comes out, anything that comes out of a non-kosher animal is non-kosher. So, for example, if you were to genetically engineer a pig so that it gives birth to other pigs that have split hooves and chew the cud, it would still not be kosher because they came from a pig. Right? Conversely, if a cow gives birth to a baby cow, let's say, you know, when the baby cow is born, right, it doesn't chew the cud yet, it's just having milk, but you can still eat it. Why? Because it came from a mother cow, and that mother cow is a kosher animal. So because eggs come from chickens, which you can eat, and because chickens come from eggs, you can eat chickens. So that is how we know, that's another way in which we know that eggs are permissible to eat. A third answer given as to how we know you can eat eggs is that as far as the laws of kosher birds go, the way it works is that the Torah gives a list of birds that are not kosher, lists about 20 or so birds that are not kosher, and all the rest are kosher. Now, amongst the non-kosher birds on that list is the Bat Haya'ana. Now, the Bat Haya'ana is usually understood to be the ostrich. However, the ostrich is also referred to elsewhere in scripture just as the Ya'ana alone. So why here is it called the Bat Haya'ana, which literally means the daughter of the ostrich? So some of the commentators explain that is referring to the egg of the ostrich, that the Torah is speaking or alluding here that the eggs of non-kosher birds are non-kosher, which the implication would be that the eggs of kosher birds are kosher. So that's three different ways in which we know that eggs are kosher to eat. It's a good question. If you ever want to stump a rabbi, ask him how do we know that eggs are kosher to eat and they're not considered even menachai. Okay, so given that certain eggs are kosher to eat, i.e. the eggs of kosher birds, let's go back to our original question. When you go to a supermarket, how can you buy eggs without a hesher, without a vinic certification? How do you know that the eggs that you see on the shelves are actually from a kosher bird? How do you know that they're chicken eggs? How do you know they're not eggs of a non-kosher bird? Any ideas? Okay, no one's suggesting any answers. Well, you know, you could say that it's just because, you know, they're labeled as being chicken eggs. The companies, the manufacturers could get in trouble with the, what's it called? The food authority, whatever the name is, if they're passing off non-chicken eggs as chicken eggs. However, we know that in halacha, that alone is not necessarily enough. Let's take the example of milk. So milk too, right? Anything that's advertised as cow milk legally has to be cow milk, and if the manufacturer is not selling cow milk, then they can be fined. So that does suffice for most people. Right? Many people say that that's okay for halakhic purposes, and you can eat milk without rabbinic certification. But there are some people who say, no, that's not sufficient. Right? There are some people who are particular to only eat challah Yisrael, to only eat milk that's been produced under rabbinic certification, because they say that the fact that there's, you know, legal, economic reasons why the stores are only selling cow milk is not enough when it comes to halakha. Yet the same people, they will eat eggs even without rabbinic certification. So why is it with eggs that it's okay to buy an egg without any form of rabbinic kosher certification? So the answer is as follows. The Talmud points out that there is a way of telling apart kosher eggs from non-kosher eggs. It's not foolproof, but it works fairly well. And that is as follows. On the whole, the eggs of kosher birds are pointed and round at the other end. But with non-kosher eggs, generally they're either pointed at both ends or rounded at both ends. Let me show you some eggs. This is a very exciting study. Okay. You see this egg? Anyone guess what it's from? Very large bird, that's correct. Which one? Yeah, it's, as we mentioned, non-kosher bird. And the ostrich egg, you'll see it's not shaped like a chicken's egg, right? It's rounded at both ends. It's not pointed at one end. Okay? So I have here another egg. Let me put that down. So the ostrich egg is the largest single cell in the entire universe. Okay, what about this egg? Anyone tell me what this egg is? No. Reptile eggs are very different. Reptile eggs, they don't have hard shells like this. So this is the egg of an emu, which is a large bird from Australia. Stands about 5 feet tall with very shaggy feathers. And it lays these olive green or black eggs. Very beautiful eggs. And you'll see this egg is pointed at both ends, right? The emu is a non-kosher bird. And this egg is pointed at both ends. So, on the whole, the eggs of non-kosher birds are either pointed at both ends or rounded at both ends. Whereas the eggs of kosher birds are generally pointed at one end and rounded at the other end. Now, this isn't an absolute rule. As I mentioned, this is just speaking in general terms. But for halachic purposes, you can group this together with a factor that, you know, there are legal reasons why the stores will not be selling eggs of anything other than chickens. Right? So when you put these two facts together, the fact that the eggs of kosher birds are generally identifiable as such, plus the fact that there are legal reasons for the store to be only selling chicken eggs, that is why we can buy eggs without rabbinic certification. Okay, but if you're in some, you know, foreign third world country, you're in some market and someone's selling an egg, right, you would not be able to buy any of it unless you have very good reason to know what it, to know where it came from. So again, this is an interesting question. You know, you ask people, why is it that you can buy eggs without rabbinic certification? And people don't know the answer. You know, they'll first say, because, well, you know, it's got to be from a chicken, but point out that that logic doesn't work with milk. Right? Not everyone will buy milk without kosher certification. So that's an interesting question with regarding to the kosher state. Now, I just want to get back briefly to discussing the kosher status of birds as opposed to eggs. So as I mentioned, the Torah lists about 20 birds that are not kosher, and all the rest are kosher. However, the problem is that we don't know exactly what the birds on the Torah's list are. We don't know exactly how to translate those names. We have a pretty good idea, but we're not exactly sure. So because of that, we only eat a bird if we have a Masorah, a continuous tradition of that bird being eaten. Right? So the birds, that, you know, the kosher birds that we eat are birds that have a Masorah, that have a continuous tradition that those birds were eaten, and we won't eat a bird otherwise. So there's a question you can ask about. There is one bird that we eat which does not have a Masorah. Can you think which one that is? Right? No. So how can we eat turkey? So this is an interesting question. A few hundred years after people started eating turkey. Now, no one's exactly sure why people started eating turkey. It seems perhaps there was some kind of mistake. It might be that people did not realize that this was a new bird. People actually thought that turkey had come from Turkey, hence the name. So people started eating it, right, Indian chicken. It seems that when people started eating it, they thought it was just part of the general category of kosher birds. Now, once it was realized, no, this bird was strictly from the Americas. So at that point, people have been eating it for a long time. Now, as I said, any bird that's not in the Torah's list is kosher. We don't know exactly which birds are not in the Torah's list, so we operate with a Masorah. However, we do have a pretty good idea of which birds are and are not in the Torah's list. You know, in general, the birds on the Torah's list are things like birds of prey or otherwise, you know, carnivorous birds such as storks and so on. They're not game birds, right? Game birds, you know, small, fat birds that make good eating, things like quail and partridge, you know, and chicken and guinea fowl, those kinds of things are not in the Torah's list. Right? So you can be pretty sure that that the turkey is not one of the birds in the Torah's list. Because we're not exactly sure what the birds are, so we operate in this principle that you can only eat a bird if you have a Masorah. But in a case like this, where people had already been eating turkey for generations and generations, we weren't going to, we're not going to suddenly declare that turkey cannot be eaten, which would make those previous generations look pretty bad. So that's why, in this case, you know, they turned a blind eye to it, and we still allow turkey to be eaten. Put them on the fingers in one hand. And it's true to say, on the other hand, that if turkey were discovered today for the first time, it would not receive kosher. You know, like peacocks. Peacocks are really in the same category. Peacock is a bird that no one really seriously thinks that the peacock is one of the non-kosher birds listed in the Torah. Again, it's a game bird. But because there's no kosher, because there's no tradition, there's no Masorah for it, that's why nobody, no halakhic authority, is going to give you a hasher on turkey. But if you did find some community of people that have been eating peacock for a long time, you wouldn't bat an eyelid. You know, you'd take it as a given that it's a kosher bird. Okay, stepping up there for how long they were eating turkey. I think it was at least 200 years that people were eating turkey before anyone thought to ask this question that, well, this is an American bird. Now, as well as kosher and non-kosher birds in the Torah, you also find mention of certain insects being kosher, i.e. certain locusts. And the Torah mentions suggestions of certain locusts are kosher. I have eaten locusts myself. They're quite delicious. Crunchy on the outside. The question is, though, what people ask is that with locusts, again, the Torah gives certain signs and names certain. It's not exactly clear what the Torah is talking about, and therefore with locusts, too, you can only eat locusts if you have a Masara tradition for eating them. And the Moroccans and the Yemenites, they have a tradition as to which type of locust is kosher. It's the Egyptian desert locust. So they eat locusts. So what people wonder is that I am not Yemenite or Moroccan, as you might be able to tell. So how can I use their tradition to eat locusts? So the answer is as follows. If I, as an Ashkenazi Jew, right, if Ashkenazi Jews were to have a tradition that locusts were not kosher, then we could not rely on the Moroccan and Yemenite traditions that they are kosher. I'll give you an example. There was a certain community in Europe that had a tradition to eat storks. Right? They had a tradition that the stork, the one of baby fame, is a kosher bird. However, we, the rest of us, we have a tradition that the stork is the chasida. And the chasida is a bird mentioned, is one of the non-kosher birds on the Torah's list. So because we have an active tradition that the stork is a non-kosher bird, we can't rely on the tradition of other people that it's a kosher bird. But in the case of locusts, it's different. It's not that we have a tradition that these locusts are not kosher. It's just that we don't have a tradition either way. Right? Because locusts are not found in Western Europe, so the Ashkenazi communities just didn't have any tradition of any kind concerning locusts. So in the absence of any tradition, we're allowed to rely on according to many rabbis, we're allowed to rely on the Yemenite and Moroccan traditions that the locusts, as to which locusts are kosher, and we can eat them. You don't have to shech the locust, you just have to kill it in some way before you eat it. The recommended way is to drop it in boiling water. And there's different ways of cooking it. You can do chocolate-covered locusts, or the way I usually do them is you fry them. You fry them in a pan, bit of oil and seasoning, and you pull off the wings and the legs. Some people like the legs, but I find they get stuck in your teeth. And you kind of unscrew the head, you eat it, and they're very nutritious, very high in protein, low in fat. As to why certain locusts are kosher, whereas other bugs are not kosher, so, again, we can have questions as to why some animals are kosher. It's the domesticated or gentle ones that are kosher, whereas the predatory, carnivorous ones are not kosher. But with insects, we see something very practical, which is that when locusts would swarm and they would destroy everyone's crops, right, so there'd be nothing left to eat. But because of the laws of the Torah, there is something left to eat. Locusts, right, you can eat the locusts. When the locusts come and they wipe out everything you've got, at least you can eat the locusts so you won't starve. So it's a very practical kosher law. Okay, anyone have any questions on birds or on any aspects of kashrus? Okay, if you're interested, if you ever want to drop me an email, I can send you out sources and pictures relating to the topics of this class, of last week's class, of the classes. All right, so if you ever want to drop me an email, and in fact, in the coming week, it might be an idea to drop me an email before the class, I can send you the sources or pictures in advance. Yeah, Stephanie, you have a question. Regarding turkey. That's a good question. You know, what do people supply when the first turkey appears? It is a big chicken. It doesn't look anything like a chicken, but it is distinctively, you know, a game bird. It's a good question, you know. That is a good question. I don't really have a good answer for that. There is actually another way of permitting turkey, which is that there's a rule known as a hybridization test. Right? If two animals can crossbreed, then either they're both kosher or they're both non-kosher. But it's not like one creature is kosher and the other is not kosher. So I'm pretty sure that it is possible to crossbreed turkeys with chickens. We also crossbreed them. So that'll be another further grounds for permitting choking. Rick wants to know whether any fouls are prohibited. By foul, I presume you mean game birds. So, again, the first list of non-kosher birds, there's no game birds. It's things like eagles, vultures, falcons, hawks, owls, storks, seagull, the ostrich, nothing that comes close to being a game bird. Question now about buffalo, right? Buffalo, the American buffalo, there's also no masorah for eating it. So, firstly, because it's a mammal, it doesn't matter, right? In America, we will, as long as it has split hooves and chews the cud, you can eat it. You don't need this tradition. There are some people in Israel who follow a ruling that even with mammals, you need to have such a tradition. But for them, also, it shouldn't be an issue because you can crossbreed a buffalo with a cow. Right? What do you get if you crossbreed a buffalo with a cow? Beefalo. So, because you can crossbreed, that's not a joke, that's really what it's called. So because you can crossbreed a buffalo with a cow, that's why another reason why it would be a kosher animal that you can eat, which I have eaten myself. Okay, so that's the end of tonight's class. I will see you all next week.